Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. Sitting across from me, daintily eating salad. There's nothing dainty about that. Is Darren.
Heyo.
That was just Emil, who will be playing live in studio later today. But first off, we've got the boys from St. Awesome.
You did not. I don't think that's right.
I tried to like compose awesome and the name together.
Awesome, right?
Yeah.
Right. I dig it.
Yeah, and Fetsau, Spine Dival, and a numerous of other projects. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. You guys want to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Joe Carroll. I am the proprietor. And
I'm Evil, and I'm the chef at St. Anselm.
So why don't you give us a little bit of a backstory on how, you know, your little corner Williamsburg restaurant empire became to be?
really by accident. I was working in the music business for a decade. That my background was in music. I studied musicology in school. My dad was a booking agent. I never thought I would do anything else with my life outside of music. And then this thing called Napster happened. And you know, when it came about and I was in the business working with all the labels, it was kind of like, oh, come on, give me a break. How is this going to
really,
you know, have any kind of impact?
No one saw the writing on the wall?
Well, no one. And that's, you know, that's a bigger point. But when I started at the major labels in like 93, most of the executives didn't know how to turn their computer on, which was just shocking to me that, you know, these major media companies were just so clueless about technology. And, you know, their feeling was they ran the show. They were the cash cows. They were the big guys in the room, and nobody was going to dictate to them how they were going to sell their music. They were wrong.
I guess before the idea that music and media could be free, with the exception of, you know, buying movies on the street, bootleg,
right,
things like that, right, I can understand why people would have no idea what it would turn into.
Yeah, it was not only did they not foresee it being free or really democratized, but it was just being clueless of the technology that, right, that could enable it. They could have, you know, this could have been a very different story had they been hipper to it in, say, 95 or 94, you know, and kind of been on the cutting edge of the technology end of it, which they were not at all.
I always wonder if the music industry had embraced online digital technology, if we'd be sitting at if we wouldn't have seen the collapse of the entire industry.
I don't think so, at least not the way it happened. And the point was, as it got worse and worse with each passing year, they doubled down
on doubling down.
Yeah,
suing.
On their standpoint.
I mean, my favorite is when you'd hear about things about, you know, grandmothers who were getting sued because their grandson had downloaded one or two copyrighted songs for $1 million. And you just, you know, they start just becoming someone very easy to hate.
Oh yeah, no question.
So the writing was on the wall.
Yeah, the writing was certainly on the wall.
Sorry, I always wonder, you know, about that.
The writing was, I was working for a trade magazine that, up until this time, was probably the most powerful overall influence at the record labels and at radio.
Can you say who?
Hits Magazine.
Okay.
And because I'm not in business anymore, I don't care if they come after me.
Right.
But Hits Magazine was really powerful. They controlled radio and retail, and they placed most of the executives at the record labels. They were huge, and they had a gigantic impact. And if you didn't play the game with Hits, you probably didn't get much airplay, and you probably didn't do very well at retail either. And now they are a footnote in the whole scheme of the record industry at this point. So when things dried up with Hits, I started working a little bit on the internet end of the music industry, and then that quickly, you know, the March, what was it, March 99 or March 2000, I forget now what year it was. It was a while ago when you know, things kind of collapsed on the internet end.
Oh, yeah, early 2000, the dot-com bust?
Yeah. And
not a great time.
No, and you know, it was, I was looking for jobs back at the labels, and so was everybody else who throughout the, you know, mid to late 90s left the, you know, normal old school part.
So you're competing with people in a saturated field that all have similar
You know, I was competing with senior VPs, people who were, you know, 10, 15 years older than me and had been around a lot longer and made a lot more money than me. So I realized, I knew from that point on that my days in the industry were done.
Right.
And I didn't want to go down with the ship, quite frankly. It was, you know, I wasn't going to just do it to do it. I realized one day, it was a difficult decision. It was a hard pill to swallow because I only thought I would ever do that. And then one day, as I was looking through Hits Magazine, I realized as I'm looking through the charts that I don't really care about any of these artists.
Right.
It's not like...
Who was big at that time?
Oh, God, that was the worst of...
Oh, was it the Boy Street?
That was the Backstreet Boys, Christina Aguilera, all that. You know, that's what was ruling the day back then. And nothing was more frustrating because I was writing for an A&R column, and a lot of what we had to do was shop artists to lawyers, to the record labels and so forth. And nothing was more frustrating than going to, you know, heads of A&R departments that I knew fairly well, playing the music and having them blown away by the music and saying, I love this, man, but I can't sign this. They won't let me sign this. There's no way. And that was, I think, a year of that made me realize, what am I doing? What, right. You know, what the hell's going on? So anyway, freaked out for a while. I had turned 30 and was no longer working in music, and I actually left Manhattan. I was living in Manhattan for years, and the building I was in was rent stabilized, and the stabilization expired. My rent went up like $1,000. I moved out back out to Jersey from where I'm from, to my parents' house. They own a four-family house, so I got an apartment in the house I grew up in for very cheap. My girlfriend and I, who's now my wife, and it didn't really affect me. I was working from home mostly then, but she was commuting from Jersey now, like, to just a couple blocks away from where we used to live. And we did that for a while, and like I said, I kind of freaked out, didn't know what I was going to do. Had an idea for a beer bar that, you know, quite frankly, I thought I would do when I retired, not when I was, you know, turning 30. And
well, your retirement just got pushed out a little bit.
That's true, exactly. And but I had no background in the business, man. I didn't, you know, I worked for about 5 months for this Belgian restaurant in Manhattan called Belgo in between jobs. Basically, because
I'm sorry.
Yeah, they spend.
Do you remember Belgo?
No, how long they spent on that name?
Oh, well, Belgo is an interesting story in and of itself. Belgo is this restaurant in Covent Garden in London that blew up, became huge, and they opened up another couple of ones in the UK. And then they came to the States thinking they were going to be equally as huge. And, you know, it was a combination of the fact that they were like the seventh Belgian restaurant to open up in New York, not the first. And they came in thinking they were really going to, you know, do some damage in the New York restaurant market, and didn't have a clue. And they lasted 18 months. And the food was good, and the concept was great. They spent probably millions more than they should have on the build-out. But I think I learned more from working there because they were so screwed up and wrong-headed, and they made so many mistakes. That I learned more from that than had I gone to work.
Yeah, you got to see all the mistakes in 5 months. You got to see all a real crash course.
Right.
As long as it's not your failure.
Exactly. Right? Somebody else's money. And then I went back to work in the music business after that for a while, and then all this stuff happened. So I had this idea. My girlfriend talked me into doing it. And we took my dad had given me a little money. I'd saved up money for buying an apartment in the city, and then put the rest of the money on credit cards and just kind of went for it, like cluelessly, not really. I mean, I knew beer really well. I knew exactly the concept I wanted, but I had no idea about the business itself. I figured I'd figure it out. But the point was that, like, I went into it thinking, look, I just got to, you know, make this work so I can pay my bills. I just want to be happy not working for somebody else. And that was the key.
And so you kept the music ideals of, you know, being your own boss and just transferred it over.
Yeah, and that was a tough thing for me because I worked for this magazine for so many years that's based out of California. I was their only employee in New York. I didn't have a boss or an office, you know, that I had to deal with every day. And I knew it was going to be tough for me to just go work in some cubicle somewhere. So that was kind of out of the question.
Right.
And like I said, you know, we went into it with relatively low expectations. We didn't need to make tons of money doing this. That wasn't the point. The point was just to not work for somebody else and pay our bills and live happy and be cool. But I knew I didn't want to be a bartender. And we bartended there. My wife Kim and I bartended there for the first couple of years nonstop. And first of all, bartending is a really physical, grueling job.
Especially
just as
in New York.
Kitchen is. Yeah, especially in New York. And you get crowded and, you know, you're working your ass off on a weekend night and lugging kegs and cases. And it just beat you up. My back was messed up for about a year after I stopped working behind the bar. And it's just, you know, your feet and legs are a mess. And I just wasn't as good at it as other people, you know. And you know, working in
which
the kitchen.
Which is actually, like, I mean, and you know, that actually I want to get to that a little bit later between the two of you. But recognizing your strengths and weaknesses and being honest about that
is huge.
I know we laugh, but like, that's a big thing. You're like, I'm fucking
no question. Yeah. No question. And I knew my strength was in my knowledge of what the product was I was selling and the concept and how to execute that concept. I knew I was good at doing those things. So I knew that once we were able to, we basically lived off very little money the first few years, paid back all our debt in about 18 months.
That's amazing.
And wow. Yeah. We were lucky. Right out of the box, we were doing fairly well. Well enough that, you know, we could live meagerly and also pay all our debt back. So 18 months of paying off all our debt, and all of a sudden it was, well, hey, maybe we could do this again some other way, you know? And I had a lot of different ideas of things I wanted to do.
And what year is this?
Well, we opened in 03. We opened Spite and Dival September 03. And Kim and I probably worked behind the bar until 05, 06, somewhere around there. I tapered off. The last year or so, I only worked like Friday nights. And I had a probably four or so different ideas of things I wanted to do next. And I remember I had to go to jury duty, and I came back. It was this kind of crappy, rainy winter day. And JD, who owns Oslo Coffee around the corner from us, told me about the space across the street from me that was available for rent. And I went to take a look at it, and it was this old mechanics garage. And it was small, and it was kind of, I don't know, it's going to be tough to pull something off in here, but I knew right away that the barbecue idea I had would work really well here, would fit really well. I'd been into barbecue for a long time, taught myself how to barbecue. The first few years we were open at Spite, and we would close on the 4th of July. I would smoke meat all night long and invite all our regulars in and our staff and everything, and we'd have this big barbecue party. So I really wanted to do a barbecue place. I felt like it wasn't being represented terribly well in New York City. At least, even if the food was good at some of these places, the whole vibe just didn't match up. You know, it was, you know, white tablecloths and wine lists just, to me, don't equate with a barbecue place, you know? And so when I saw this garage, I realized, all right, this is a cool space to do this barbecue thing in. And again, not having the background, my managers and friends and everybody tease me still to this day that I was trying to convince myself and everyone else that we were really just opening a bar that happened to have some barbecue as food.
Right. And is that how you felt when you were in the kitchen? Just a bar that just happened to have... Yeah. No.
We realized, no. I think, opening night that was not going to be the case.
I was there opening night.
Were you really?
Yes, I was.
You know, something happened that I've since, obviously, I'm very aware of today, but back then I just didn't... I had no reference point to it, and that was food blogs. Yeah. And... you know, when I opened Spite, nobody knew who I was or what I was going on. We just opened the door one night and started doing business. And it started catching on, and very quickly we started getting some good press. What I didn't realize is that press was sort of building over those first 3 years or so. And when word kind of slowly leaked out that we were doing this barbecue place, it hit the food blogs and people started really buzzing about it, unbeknownst to me. So when we opened opening night, we were just overwhelmed. We had no idea that the line was going to be down the block. We were going to run out of food at 9 o'clock. And that was sort of the beginning of it all.
So how did you two meet, or when did you come into the picture?
A couple of years after you were open already.
A year or two later. I think only a year later
Came on. Yeah, I was taking a break from cooking. I was just delivering food on my bike. So I started working one day a week, or a couple of days a week, delivering food for Feta Sal, then got a meat cutting shift.
I feel like when I first met you, we were doing the shows at McCarran Pool. That was right around, so I think that was the next summer.
Fill in here and there and do stuff, just kind of random.
Right.
So we're going to just take a quick musical break, and then I want to talk about the relationship you two have about developing the menu for the new restaurant and growth and Williamsburg
and the barbecue this Wednesday.
This is off the new Beach House record, and the song is called Troublemaker. Thank you.
All right, just a little beach house. I mean, if it's kind of like a gloomy Monday.
Which is fine after such a beautiful weekend. You guys get slammed on the weekends when it's that pretty?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I think Brooklyn in general works on the reverse model as Manhattan. In the warm weather in the summer, on the weekends, we're the busiest. Whereas in Manhattan, the summer weekends are usually the quietest because everyone's out of town. You know?
So, Fetisal goes well. A space across the street opens up next to Spite and Dive.
Hold on, wait. We skipped over something. Because we only got to the opening day of Fetisal and then like a year in. How did you deal with the whole urban barbecue scene and where did you guys fit in?
You know, I honestly, I don't really pay attention to any of that stuff. I know what's going on, don't get me wrong, but I'm not, like, caught up in it. I'm not concerned about what other people are doing. I'm only concerned what I do. So I'm going to do what I do regardless of what anything else is going on around me, you know? And so I really didn't think about how we fit in. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do, and that was that, you know? Yeah, I never really gave it much thought. I know Matt Lang, who was the chef who opened Feta with me, I purposely hired because he was young, inexperienced, and had no barbecue background.
Beautiful.
And it was perfect for me because we were not trying to be North Carolina barbecue or Texas barbecue.
Sometimes it's just good to start with a blank slate.
Yeah.
I mean, understanding food and business, obviously, but, you know.
No, I knew he could cook. I was confident in that. And he seemed like he had his head on his shoulders. I knew him marginally well. He was a regular at Spite and Dival. And he was working at the Pearl Oyster Bar. And I really, what attracted me is he didn't have a barbecue background. And that's also what I liked about Yvonne.
And what's your process? Do you smoke? Do you get, like, guys talk about how you actually make your barbecue?
Yeah. Everything, I mean, barbecue is a technique. So, and that's the whole point, really, is it's not, you're not working off recipes. So I had a dry rub I came up with when I first got into barbecuing, and you know, it was kind of, I liked the way it worked. I used it at that point on pretty much everything I did. And aside from that, it was just staying true to the technique of barbecuing, which is just cooking slow and low with hardwood smoke, you know? And it's that simple. Now, we took that technique and applied it to a lot of cuts that, up until that point, really had never been barbecued before. From shockingly, you know, something like pork belly to things like flank steak or beef cheeks and things like that. And we still do that all the time. I think we're kind of known for that a bit, especially the belly, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of become our signature.
That pork belly sandwich is...
Yeah. I mean, the belly and the brisket are my two favorite things there by far. But so I think, you know, the idea was... I wanted a barbecue that was very traditional in the technique, but really tuned into what New York food and a New York sensibility was all about, and not trying to cop. I'm from North Jersey, man. I'm not from Texas or Memphis or, you know. And I
there's
wasn't
good
trying
barbecue
to do that.
In Jersey. Better barbecue in Jersey than some place in New York sometimes.
Yeah, there's some decent barbecue, especially down. You know, people don't know they're down south, like west of Atlantic City in that area. In the Pine Barren area, there's a lot of, in the summertime, there's a lot of like these little guys doing like chicken and ribs, smoking them out on the roadside, and it's amazing stuff. And really, you know, you drive down there in the summer and you might as well be in North Carolina or something like that.
So then how did you, so you're delivering a bike, then you start butchering things like that. Then how'd you guys come together, work together and start, you know, open up Saint Assam?
Well, Matt worked for me for 2 years and his parents were going to give him money down in Baltimore where he's from to open up a place. And Yvonne was, without a doubt, the most obvious choice to take over from there.
Yeah.
You know, and so Yvonne...
I took over for Matt.
Yeah.
And ran Fetisal for...
And it was, you know, it was perfect timing, too, because Matt was great and the type of person that was needed for the early days, because he, like, literally slept on the picnic tables there the first, like, couple of weeks we were open. So, it was, you know, we needed somebody young and kind of, like... somebody who didn't care really and just had to do whatever it took. And then when Yvonne came in, it was perfect timing because Yvonne really knew how to run the kitchen and manage the kitchen and really get everyone in you know, kind of fighting shape. And so, you know, definitely Yvonne took the management of the kitchen to a whole nother level there, you know, and the running of the place to a whole nother level. And that was exactly what was needed at that point in time because we had really started blowing up, you know.
And then, so how did you guys transition from there to the new restaurant, and how did you create the menu together, and like the role of almost like the restaurateur and the chef?
And then, and also, how did you say that, okay, we've done all that we can do at Fetisal, let's go, because it's a little bit more fine dining at Saint Assam. Because normally it's the other way. Normally it's the you do the fine dining right. and then you do the casual, but you went bar, barbecue, bistro
well,
in that order.
You know, St. Anselm was supposed to be a hamburger and hot dog joint and was for a few months. And
I'm trying to remember if I remember. Right. It was like
we were making our own sausage. We were doing kind of American, like, you know.
And you had like more of a deli counter? And,
no, it was kind of set up the same way.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was a great idea. The food was great. The burgers and dogs were exactly what we wanted. And I felt like we really nailed it. But the space was never right for it. And we had some issues with the buildings department with the space. We had to close down and we had to tear up Metropolitan Avenue and put a new water main in and all this crazy stuff. And I knew we had to close at that point. The other thing too is, you know, Williamsburg isn't the greatest lunch neighborhood, so you know, people want to eat burgers and dogs for lunch, not for dinner. You know,
I mean, I've lived here for 7 years, and every time lunchtime rolls around, I go, "What am I eating for lunch?"
Right.
And it can't be C again,
right? But there's not, you know, a lot of people work in Manhattan, so it gets quiet during the afternoons here. It's not as busy as it is at night. So all that in mind, I knew we had to close for a while, and I knew it would give me an opportunity to really reformulate the place. And I went to Yvonne and asked him if he wanted to be part of it, and kind of had a sketch of an idea at that point, but we kicked around a few others. And I think it was probably, I don't know, what do you think, it was like last February or January when we like said, all right, this is what we're going to do, this is the concept.
Yeah, somewhere around there, yeah.
And then what is the process machine do of like adding and taking things off the menu, or how does that type of dialogue happen?
I mean, you just try things out. You know, we were trying out recipes and different cuts of meats and just try them out, have people come over and get feedback, and then, you know, then you got your menu, and then once you open, if something really just doesn't move, you gotta...
Was there anything on there that... you saw it as a surprise, or one of you fought for it, and everyone was like, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, and it really took off?
Well, I think we were both pretty much on the same page with what we wanted. There was a couple of things we did take off because mostly because they weren't working the way we wanted them to. Yeah. It never really became what we thought it would be, you know.
Or just too labor intensive, or just too much space on the grill was the main thing, you know. That
I love that grill that you guys have in there. And it's just, it's rocking out a night. I think when I came to drop off the posters for the barbecue Wednesday, I think I got 10 seconds. And I felt bad for taking the 10 seconds from you.
Speaking of the barbecue Wednesday, you guys are going to be kicking off our first barbecue blowout, which is now in its fifth year. It's going to be taking place, for those of you who don't know, at the back of Good Company. Free entry, $10 a plate. All of our VIP advance tickets are sold out. You want to tell us what's on the menu?
Yeah, I'm going to do... some St. Louis style ribs that it's gonna be a different rub than that feta sal, but we have them smoked. We're gonna smoke them over at feta sal, and then I'm gonna have a sirloin tip steak. Just gonna grill huge steaks and slice them up, and I'm gonna make a kohlrabi coleslaw and some grilled potato wedges, and there'll be some bread pudding as well.
Amazing. I'm very excited for that.
I'm really excited for that.
And shout out to our other sponsors, Artisan Books, New York Magazine, Evian Water, Brooklyn Brewery, and the guys at Good Co.
Yeah, and Gilt.
And Gilt.
That's awesome. And finally, I would say, what is your tip for anybody who actually wants to eat at St. Anselm, since it's almost impossible?
Come early.
Yeah, come early.
Yeah.
Come early with this... smallest group of people as you can.
You know, I actually,
we don't have a lot of big tables.
When I went the first time, Justin Cherno, who is DJing on Wednesday from Turing Machine, he's the one who took me there. We put our name. We went on a Monday. We put our names in. We got free wings over at Lodge.
Nice.
And then when you guys called us, we came back.
Nice.
Which I thought was
that's a good
That was a good punch. All right, well, guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah,
appreciate it. On, we'll see you guys both on Wednesday.
Absolutely.
And thanks. So we're going to play one song from Father John Misty, song called Only Son of Lazeman, and then we will be back live in studio with the meal. You're listening to Snacky Tunes.
When I heard the ladies' man was dead, I saw the Rolling Stones stop moving. Saw my ancient hero on the sunset strip. He left behind a legacy of ruin. Now painted ladies wanna hold my gun, wonder if the whole time I've been acting. When I sang Moon River in that silent film, had I really made a sound when they called action? I swear that man was womankind's first husband. Troubled heart was beating in a sequined dress. Someone must console these lonesome daughters. No written word or ballad will appease them. The cowboy and the cop shot down the lady. Midnights in LA are now silent. I swear that man was womankind's first husband.
All right, Father John Misty, who is playing live this Friday at the Mercury Lounge. Emil, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for having me, dude. Thanks for feeding me, too. That first pizza, man, that the second.
Yeah, I had. What one was that?
Famous Original.
Looked awesome. Yeah. So your bio is pretty whimsical that you have out. So although I've read it, I know nothing about you.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you give us a little background story about who you are and where you're from and how you came to
that's, yeah, I guess that's true. I'm gonna have to check out the bio. It's ever changing, but it maintains its whimsical shape.
No, it's like if I got it as a press release for a record, it's awesome. It's like really like sets the stage.
Yeah, but when
I'm supposed to
appear on a radio station and you're supposed to talk to me, you don't know if I'm from an insane asylum. I don't know. I was born and raised in Boston, and I grew up DJing, playing a bunch of different instruments, and I went to college, and it was not the time for me, as I compulsively just made music in my dorm room.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Skidmore College briefly, and then transferred to New England Conservatory, and decided neither were my cup of tea. And
got
I
it.
Sort of traveled around and started making a lot of electronic music, and started singing, writing songs, and everything sort of combined itself. And I settled back in Boston around the time that a lot of bands were up and coming. Bands like Yes Giant Test and Passion Pit, who were sort of setting the stage for the sort of like electronic influence music that was coming out of that area. And then I started to put out some records at the suggestion of some of the people in that network, and eventually I got some press related to this this fake press release that I suggested we put out with my friend who's now my manager, which had me being Emil Hirsch, the actor, putting out an extended play like as if you made it on the set of some movie. And it was also kind of a fuck you to music critics of the time of today, the fact that people are celebrity whores and that music
like
can be,
they would pick it up just because it's famous.
Right. I mean, the question was like, my music could be good or bad, people could like it or not, but what is going to make a blogger open up an email next to 200 other emails that day? It's the fact that they're a celebrity whore, and I am. And if you don't say you are, then you might be lying. I don't know. Maybe you're not a celebrity whore.
I'm like, it depends on the celebrity.
Depends on the celebrity.
Yeah. It's like a 50-50.
Yeah.
It is.
I would love to hear who's not on your list.
Who's not on your list?
Of like,
who should be on your list that's not on your list?
Like, you mean like if I got an email like so-and-so started a band?
No, if you got an email like so-and-so wants to be on your radio station. Oh, well, who would you not turn?
Yeah, that's not really fair because we book like 50 shows a year. Like, anyone's welcome.
Okay.
So, so how was the response to that press release?
It was, I mean, I got posts scattered everywhere. People were reviewing this little digital EP that I put out of some fun original music, and it was all kind of, people were confused. They didn't know if it was some celebrities putting it out. A lot of people got it because they were writing the review and they were like, wait a minute, there's no way that this is this fucking actor, you know?
Yeah.
And then they giggled about it and they got the point. There were a couple blogs internationally, a blog in France that was like, you'll never work in this town again because you lied about so-and-so.
How's that working out for you?
Yeah, I don't, you know, who knows?
Right.
I don't know what this guy in his bedroom writing about music, I'm sure he's pretty upset still. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's what people, as we were saying earlier about, I guess when we weren't on air, but since he was leaving the music industry around the time, it's difficult for musicians to get heard these days.
Are you talking about Joe leaving?
Yeah. And I think people do a lot of things out of desperation. I didn't necessarily do. I did that to poke fun at people. But at the end of the day, I got a great offer from an awesome label, and I moved to New York City and been working with some bands.
You can name check the label.
Okay, cool. It's Cantora Records.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will, for getting me on here.
And you can name check your friend who's your manager, too.
Yes, Ben Krako. Thank you for everything, buddy.
Why don't we hear a song?
Yeah, awesome.
What's it called?
This is off a record that's on Cantora Records right now. It's called Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. I wrote it about one of my roommates while I was living in this warehouse off Bedford, who secretly was like 36 years old, pretending to be like 22, and was trying to sleep with like this French girl who was like living with us, and it was kind of just hilarious. And I can't go much further than that because I don't want to single anybody out. Not like that.
That wasn't like the most specific call. He was my old roommate.
Well, there were 12 of us.
Oh, okay.
It was a little bit of a commune. Although I was like very anti-commune. I was sort of the Republican in the commune, which is a very weird thing to be. Anyway, I'll shut up and play this song. Okay. Cadillac slicking its lips to a faraway place with a landing strip. Pull me like a string toy, watch your mouth punch me in the stomach and the world pops out. I'm hiding down with a cigarette stares. C'est la vie, no Alibaba and the 40 thieves, looting for gold like you wouldn't believe. Looting for gold like you wouldn't believe. Businessman on a two-way street and a ring on his finger and a lie in his sheets. Whoa, Betty drapers raging on the front lawn with a rifle in your face and a bathrobe. Oh. Madame with a cigarette stares. Say la vie, no underwear. Alibaba and the 40 thieves looting for gold like you wouldn't believe. Looting for gold like you wouldn't believe. Confess, a bunch of DJs taking your requests. So what should I wear tonight? Example set by mother and man raised up a girl with a gun in her hands. Polish up a quarter, put it in the machine. Lovers only know what you let them say. Madame with a cigarette stares. Say la vie, no underwear. And pretty little legs with hips for hats. Isn't much more we can say about that.
So did he get the girl?
I moved out, but a little while later I heard that he moved to, like, you know, a big fancy loft. He was also secretly rich, obviously. Oh. I don't know. I don't
know. Was he slumming?
Oh, he was slumming it. He was slumming it big time. And then he moved to one of those waterfront luxury places. And then I heard that she couldn't resist, but it's cool. It's cool, man. I mean, like, I had a thing with her, but it wasn't a thing. It was sort of like we would go out and have fun and go to the movies and stuff and language barrier problems and, you know, the usual.
So you moved to New York, you got the record deal, and mm-hmm. So, you know, how's your, and when was, what year was that?
That was a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Okay, so how's, like, what has the last year and a half held?
It's been cool. I've been putting out releases. We put out an EP, the same EP that I talked about distributing under that, the little false celebrity impersonation thing. That was re-released by Cantor Records, and they got some great response, and then we put out a full length in October, and I've been gigging, you know, different setups with bands and opening for people and playing great venues around Brooklyn, and went to South by Southwest, so making the rounds and doing everything you know, to make things work, and working on a new record right now. So,
and so as a, you know, new musician, to kind of tie back into Joe, you know, you did the one thing, well, not the one thing, but you got your name out there, and so, like, what have you done to follow it up? Has there been any more, you know, creative PR moves? Or, and I don't think, I wouldn't say gimmick, because that's not the right word anymore.
Well, yeah.
And you said desperate to be heard, but I think it's all just, like, cutting across the noise.
It is cutting across the noise, and it's giving people a reason to listen. In general, talking about how whimsical the bio is and stuff like that, I mean, I think once you have the attention of, like, a little group of people or a demographic, I think it's really important, you know, however you get that attention, you really start being yourself. And if you put music out honestly that you want to make that reflects who you are, regardless of how you get their attention, if you want to keep it, you got to start, you know, pulling out of the well that will never drain, you know. So, mm-hmm. You know, I do a lot of remixes. It's, you know, it's awesome to come here with an acoustic guitar and play some songs.
Yeah, I was going to say that's when Will was like, hey, he's going to play acoustic guitar. Yeah. And I was like, okay. And I listened to a record and I went, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and people, and, you know, that's what I'm still trying to figure out is, like, what is the best way to represent what I do, mm-hmm. with an instrument, you know? Because mm-hmm. There's playing something that's passable or good or enjoyable, but there's also, like, having a style that people know you for and having that be reflected in every performance you do and stuff like that. But what was I talking about again? It's that pizza, dude. All the blood's in my stomach.
No, I know. Just about, you know, cutting across the noise.
Oh, cutting across the noise, yeah. I mean, like I was saying, I do a lot of electronic music, and remixing and covering artists and having, like, a lot of automated, you know, it's MIDI running through synths, drum machines. I mean, a lot of what I do musically centers around that. And that wasn't even completely reflected in the last release that I put out, as much as it was a collaboration with a bunch of different musicians and an orchestra and a horn section and stuff. It was, It was a lot more blown out on that record, but I think I'm starting to get a lot more positive response these days, as I realize you have to sort of step up to the plate, and you do have to do gimmicky things, and you do have to do remixes for people that are a lot more well known than you, and expect nothing in return. But I mean, I just did a cover of a Neon Indian song, Polish Girl. Which was I was pretty happy with how it turned out. People, it's a really positive response. But we put it out. Nylon Magazine premiered it, and it's sort of.
Do you want to drop it? You want to play it?
Yeah, sure. If you can find the link up right now, but I was going to say,
can you do it on the acoustic?
No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, there's no way I could do it justice. But if you're talking about dropping it now, that's not, no.
Okay.
Sadly, I have to refuse.
That's fine. Politely. Just say it's some legal stuff.
Yeah, it's some legal stuff.
Oh, okay. So why don't we just hear another song then?
All right, cool.
And the full name of the new record is?
The record that, yeah, we're promoting now is called Lo and Behold, and it's on Cantor Records. And there's a single coming out in a couple weeks with an original B-side. We'll be promoting this all summer, playing some shows. So if you're listening, check it out.
What's the song called?
This is one that is not off the record. It's called Sleep in the Garden.
All right, live on Snacky Tunes.
Thanks, guys.
Persistence will astound you till I've found you asking me to be with you. I suppose sleeping in my garden till it grows. I wonder, willow trees thinking, is my excessive drinking causing the loss of all sensation in my toes? Wake up and smell the coffee flavor. Social network stunt where all the teens take off their clothes. I suppose sleeping in this garden till it grows.
Nice. So when you go into the studio to record a record, are you thinking that it's, you know, you go and you're like, oh, I'm going to do 10 songs. Are you like, I've got 10 songs plus some B-sides plus some free songs? Like, what's your approach these days, you know, for material?
Well, I'm in an interesting position because I write and record and produce and do most of that, control it all, you know, do it myself. So I'm constantly churning out these little demos and pilots where I record tons of instruments and I do, you know, these 1 or 2 minute things that are like a verse and a chorus and this idea of a song. And when I sat down to make a record, I basically take those and I put them all together and I play Tetris with them and see what works and what doesn't. Making this last record, I sort of sat down with Jake Aaron, who did a great job engineering and co-producing it with me. He was in a great band called Fort Lean and touring bassist for Jamie Liddell. I sat down with him and a team of other people, and I was just like, let's make sense of all these. And then a good friend of mine, Michael McAllister, who is an awesome Berkeley veteran, great arranger, commercial music guy, worked on string arrangements, horn arrangements for some of the ones, and sort of tried to tie everything together and make things a little more homogenous, but still very whimsical and still very sort of out to lunch and all over the place. Because the idea with the record that we're currently supporting and the one that came out recently, it's like every song is kind of a different genre, and it's very eclectic and it jumps around. For me, I mean, going into the studio is very different than a musician who goes in with an instrument or goes in with, like, some
only
samples.
Or,
like a drum machine or, like, oh, I have a synth and a drum machine and I'm gonna like sing into a reverb thing, and it's it was more like there was like 3 or 4 weeks of like scratching our heads, like how do we do this? How do we take what you do and like work with a team of people who do this like professionally and not have everybody kill each other? But more and more, I'm learning from people that do, you know, who are like studied engineers and songwriters and everything, that there's rhyme and reason to what they do. And I think part of what makes me who I am for the people that do enjoy my music, it's that I'm very, very self-taught on all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's, but nowadays I'm just, songs start on the guitar and voice, songs start with beats that I make, songs start with synth lines that I write. But a lot of the music I'm working on right now is very, very heavy synth-based stuff. But I do play a lot of guitar over it because I'm trying to merge the things that I do and have them all be performable. But, you know, I could ramble on about that for a while. But
no, that's a very good answer. Yeah,
but most artists are in that position these days because I think we're in, like, the heyday of the, you know, bedroom producer,
mm-hmm.
you know, as, like, the respectable artist, which in many respects, you know, the performers are going to start to take over again as we see the live music is more important. You know, people like Adele winning the Grammys. I mean, it's like, you know, but I could ramble about that for a while.
No, I mean, I think there's value in that. It's like amazing what one person can do. And I think that it's easier to get started if it's just you.
Yeah.
You can put your band together, you can do that, but you're not negotiating, you know, different egos or schedules or things like that. Like, there's nothing holding you back. So, but I mean, Adele's interesting thing is, like, she's the voice. I mean, yeah, there might have been people writing for her, but she was the one who was singing beforehand. So it's one person. I still think, like, it'll be some time before, you know, we'll see a 10-person band get big or something like that. You know, one, two, three, maybe four piece at the most. But it's an interesting point.
Yeah.
So what do you have coming up this summer?
I am working on original tracks to sort of B-sides to singles that we're putting out. So we had this cool idea that as we cut off singles from the record that we've already released, that I'm going to, since they're all such different styles, I'm like making original B-sides that fit with each track. So like I have a very like urban music imitating track called CUPID, which is like this sort of Timbaland beat with vocoder stuff, and it's sort of like, I was also for years I was actually a hip-hop producer, you know, that juxtaposed with what I'm doing now, it's a very strange mix. But I've been working a lot trying to support singles with new material that sounds like, you know, each one's turf.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, so, you know, just some I'm trying to mess around with, and you know, writing another record, recording it now, producing it now, for consideration for the fall time. I'm producing a couple acts in the area. I'm doing some session work for a couple projects that I'm also engineering and mixing and helping write. And I'm going to be in here a lot this summer, drinking the gin and juice over there. But I have to say, the first time I came in here, it was called Frozen Margarita.
For Roberta's?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that different, or is it the same exact thing? Because it told me it was just, it's basically Frozen Margarita with gin.
So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, different.
It's different.
Hey, it's you know, cutting across the noise.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is cutting across the noise.
So if people want to find you, download you, tweet at you, hit you up for shows, where can they find you?
EmileAndFriends.fm. You can go to CantorRecords.com. You can look us up on Twitter, Emile and Friends. And that's not ampersand. The ampersand is not web-supported. That is A-N-D, Emile and Friends. And just type us in on Facebook and you'll find us. And things are building up, so, you know, come check us out. And we'll be putting out a lot of music on the net and playing some shows this summer. So
awesome. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You want to take us out with one more song?
Sure, yeah.
What's the name of the song?
The song right now is called Tune My Guitar.
Oh, I love that one. And for all those who want to come, again, St. Asylum Fets Out Barbecue this Wednesday.
Do it.
7 p.m. Good Company, 10 Hope Street. Some walk-up tickets left, but just like everything else that they do, get there early.
Totally. I will play one that was not on the record set, sort of like a bonus track.
Sweet.
Okay. We gave Amazon. It's called The Beast. It's one of the first songs I ever wrote. Cool. I have a
claw. I killed a bear in Nepal for recreation. It was nothing at all. Let's compare scars. Check out the one on my back. Tips for survival in a panther attack. And so the beast got away. Not before I tagged him with my homing dart. Lives in the trees anyway. Won't be long before I tear this place apart. Tear this place apart. Tear this place apart. Tear this place apart. We met a mountain man while we were setting up camp. He had a rifle and he carried a lamp. Asked him where he's headed, he said somewhere up north. I asked him what he's doing and I said I'm rich and I'm bored. Travel the world for a change, looking for somewhere to hunt some game. Business is good, I can't complain, but city living has me going insane, and I can't take anymore. Can't take anymore. We laid a trap which this panther couldn't resist. To call it all off, continue the trip, it's a matter of timing. And so the beast got away, not before I tagged him with my homing dart. Lives in the trees anyway. Won't be long before I tear this place up.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.